All right. When we get to these narrative books, there is a kind of a different sort of challenge on how to set up how much we're going to cover. And so we're going to try to cover the first 14 verses today. And we are going to kind of leave off in the middle of the story, but I'm hoping it'll be sort of a cliffhanger and bring you back next week so you can see exactly what happens. Not that you don't have the book in front of you that you can read about that, but that's kind of how we're going to approach it. Okay, so just kind of as we go, and we'll come back to these as we go through the book. So just to have a baseline so you can see, these are the major theological issues that we're going to run across in 1 Kings. We're not going to see a ton of theology in the first two chapters. First two chapters are kind of setting the stage for Solomon's ascent to the throne. But we will keep, once he's there, these things are going to start coming up about every week, and we'll address them when they get there. But essentially what we've got is monotheism versus idolatry. You see a lot of that. Central worship versus the high places. You know, do I have to come to Jerusalem to worship, or can I set up my own places of worship in other places? The covenant loyalty versus spiritual rebellion. That's nothing new. Just go back to Adam and just trace it on through. That's basically it. True prophecy versus lying spirits. Most of the kings don't really like to hear from true prophets because they usually don't have good news. The Davidic covenant versus dynastic disintegration. That was just too good. I was going to rephrase that, but I was like, that's too alliterative. It's too creative. I'm going to keep that just like I found it in the commentary. So the idea of how is this Davidic covenant of a throne that's going to last forever going to keep going on when we've got these kings that keep doing stupid things and departing from God's way? And then the last part is God's sovereignty versus human pride. And I think a lot of those we can, now, you know, we don't have a central temple we have to go worship at, but we can all certainly apply number six to our lives and our country and our whatever else you want to put it into. So there, I think there's some big picture theological stuff we'll talk about, and I think there's some practical application that we can get to, too. I think there's a parenting lesson in chapter one today. I think we learned something from David's style of parenting here. So before we get to all that, we've got to establish a king. And it's always good to have Mel Brooks in your slideshow somewhere. Okay? So remember our basic timeline that we've got going on. The Exodus was 1446 B.C. We're still in B.C., so I didn't put them all up there. Joshua's conquest is 1406 to 1399. And then for about the next 20 years, that's where the tribes are supposed to be subduing the land and sorting it all out and that, and it doesn't go as planned in all places. And then the judges come in 1381 to 1050, pretty ugly time in Israel where everybody's doing right in their own eyes. Some judges are more effective than others, some are better than others, but that's the cycle that goes through in the judges. Then we've got Saul, basically you've got three 40-year reigns. Saul for 40 years, David for 40 years, Solomon for 40 years. And you'll look at some timelines, and sometimes they'll have them at 41 years or 42 years, round numbers. Okay, just remember 40, 40, 40. That's essentially what we've got going on here. So Saul about 1050 to 1010, David from 1010 to about 970, and Solomon from 970 to about 930. And then the kingdom's going to split, and we'll eventually get to that point in our readings. Okay, here's kind of the precursor to what we're reading about in chapter 1. Back in 2 Samuel chapter 7. Right? And starting in verse 12, it says, "And when thy days be fulfilled," this is the prophet speaking to David, "when thy days be fulfilled and thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, I will set up thy seed after thee, which shall proceed out of thy bowels, and I will establish his kingdom." So this is the Davidic covenant. Right? So think 2 Samuel 7, Davidic covenant, keep those two together and remember that. Okay? Can I give you a little tangent before we go past that verse? The sleep with your fathers thing? The why they think that is the terminology that they used in the Old Testament is because they buried people differently in the Old Testament and the New Testament. And so they would have the tombs, right? And you know all that, the wrappings and all that, put them in the tomb and leave them there. And in the Old Testament, you would leave the body there for a year and let all the decomposition happen. And then the sun would go in and collect the bones. Isn't that a fun job? The son would go in and collect the bones of the deceased family member, and they had a bone like pit, basically a bone repository underneath, and they would take all the bones and they would throw them down there. So you would literally sleep with your fathers because your bones would go the same place that your father's bones went and everybody else's bones went. Once you get to the New Testament, they start doing those bone boxes where they slide them into things, and you see seen some of those maybe with some of the archaeology, with a lot of hoaxes and stuff that have come out recently. But, yeah, that's what sleeping with your fathers means, because your bones literally set in the same pit as your father's bones did.
I'm glad you explained it, because it
doesn't
sound good.
I don't know that you want to be the eldest son all the time. That's probably not a fun job, but there you go. But anyway, I will set up your seed after you. It'll proceed out of your bowels. I will establish his kingdom. So David's line, his kingdom will be established. He shall build a house for my name. We know that's going to be Solomon in the immediate sense. And I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father. He shall be my son. If he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the stripes of the children of men. But my mercy shall not depart away from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before thee. And thine house and thy kingdom shall be established forever before thee. Thy throne shall be established forever. Now, this same sort of covenant is restated in Chronicles, and it's very much pointing towards Christ in Chronicles. I think when he hears this, I think a lot of people would think, well, Solomon must be that seed we've been waiting for. Solomon must be that redeemer. And then, but you get that part about if he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men. The Chronicles verse doesn't have that part, because you don't have to worry about Christ doing that. There's obviously something different going on here. And even Solomon, the wisest of men, is going to make some pretty stupid decisions at the end of his reign. And we'll see that in this book. All right, so keep this as your framework, the Davidic covenant. Because as we get to chapter 1 of Kings, it's David's dying. Who's going to be king? Who's going to take over the throne? And what does that mean for the future? So that's kind of where we are. We're in a tenuous political position when 1 Kings opens up. Okay, so let's work at the first 10 verses first to set the tone here. All right, now King David was old and stricken in years, and they covered him with clothes or blankets, maybe a better translation there, but he got no heat. He got no heat. How about that for King James? Okay? He could not get warm. Okay? They put blankets on him, and he's still shivering. We've all been there with the flu, right? That's essentially what's going on. Wherefore his servant said unto him, let there be sought for my lord the king a young virgin, and let her stand before the king, and let her cherish him, and let her lie in thy bosom, that my lord the king may get heat. So they sought for a fair damsel throughout all the coasts of Israel, and found Abishag the Shunammite, and brought her to the king. And the damsel was very fair, and cherished the king, and ministered to him, but the king knew her not. Okay, we'll talk about what's going on there. It's a little, probably wouldn't take that approach nowadays, but we'll tell you what's going on there. Then in verse 5, so he's sick, he can't get warm, even the woman coming to him can't revive him. And then verse 5, then Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, I will be king. And he prepared him chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. And his father had not displeased him at any time, in saying, why hast thou done so? And he also was a very goodly man, and his mother bare him after Absalom. And he conferred with Joab, the son of Zariah, and with Abiathar the priest, and they followed Adonijah and helped him. Okay, so Joab and Abiathar go with Adonijah. But Zadok the priest and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada and Nathan the prophet and Shimei and Rei and the mighty men which belonged to David were not with Adonijah. So we'll kind of choose sides here when we get through here. And Adonijah slew sheep and oxen and fat cattle by the stone of Zoheleth, which is by Enrogel, and called all his brethren, the king's sons, and all the men of Judah, the king's servants. But Nathan the prophet, and Benaiah, and the mighty men, and Solomon his brother, he called not. All right. So, some names in there. I got to figure out how Pastor Sean does it and just smoothly skip right over. So the story opens with David's health all but gone. I mean, really, he's on his deathbed. They've run out of remedies at this point. He was one, you know, we know David. He was a fighter. He was a politician. He was a poet. He was a musician. He was a warrior. He was all these different things. And he is now reduced to a man that can't get out of bed. Can't keep, his circulation is so bad that he can't stay warm, even with all these blankets they're throwing on him. And with death imminent, it's obvious that a new leader must replace David. You know the ancient world with kings, most of the time this stuff started rolling before the old king died. You know, they didn't wait for the king to die and then decide. People start jockeying for position when they know the end is coming. And that's exactly what we've got going on here in 1 Kings. So at the time of his death, think about what David has done for Israel. Amazing things. You know, Saul had some military successes. But you know what the women were singing when they came back? You know, Saul slew his thousands and David slew his 10,000s. You know, David was pretty pretty adept. Yes, exactly. Legendary is a good way to put it. He had subdued all these nations, Moab, Edom, Ammon, Syria, and Philistia. He had expanded Israel's borders, so it's as big as it's ever been. He's fattened Israel's treasuries. They're pretty rich when you look at how much stuff he can bring in to build the temple. He captured and built up Jerusalem, which we'll talk about in 1 Kings. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. And he gathered materials for God's temple. Remember, God said, you're not going to be able to build my temple because you're a man of war. You got too much blood on your hands, but your son can build it. But David's been bringing all that stuff in, bringing in the cedars and bringing in the gold and bringing in everything else that they can build for the temple. And then keep that covenant in mind that God had promised a kingdom that would last forever. So Israel's in pretty good shape when 1 Kings opens up. When you think about it, it's only been, less than 500 years since they were slaves in Egypt. They've come a long way in 500 years, and they're pretty powerful at this point. Okay, so why does Adonijah choose this moment to start this rebellion? Why now does he take the opportunity? And I think the answer is found in that little idea when they bring in Abishag the Shunammite in these verses through 2 through 4. Because he knows David's sick. He knows he's hurting. He knows he's on his deathbed. But he probably doesn't know the extent of how weak he is until that episode happens. And I think he's right there in the palace. So, you know, he's gonna know exactly what's going on with his father. He is the eldest son that's there. This isn't the first time that that David has experienced rebellion. Remember Absalom's rebellion that absolutely breaks his heart, and that tragedy that comes out of that. And then another time, Sheba, a Benjamite, was a one chapter there in 2 Samuel because they wanted to try to get back authority that they had under Saul. Because remember, Saul was a Benjamite. There's a short-lived rebellion there.
So I know Absalom is David's son.
Yes.
So Sheba is...
is not a relative of Saul.
Yeah,
that wants to get the power back to Benjamin. And really what you can tell is David's ability to overcome these little conflicts and these... You know, and there were other times where people, sometimes they're coups like Absalom's was. He's going to try to take over the throne. Other times it's just people trying to take power and take this and take that. And David's like the master politician. He does a great job of kind of putting those fires out whenever he needs to. And now his son, who has seen Adonijah, who has seen David be this great warrior and this great king for all these years, now sees him in bed, now sees him not be able to get warm. And what's happening in 2 through 4? The words there that are used are very sexual words. Essentially, they're sending a woman there to comfort him. They think that will, if that, maybe he can revive himself somewhat. And essentially what it's saying is David is so sick that he cannot do that. He is, for lack of a better term, impotent at that point. And Adonijah says, now's the time. You know, if we know anything about David, he was a pretty virile guy, right? I mean, and now all of a sudden he's not. And Adonijah says, he's weak. Now is the time. I can strike when the iron's hot. I can take this kingdom and I can get it. Now, Adonijah is the oldest son. So you can see why he would think he's the guy that needs to take over. The problem is he's kind of jumping the gun and not listening to what Israel does. So who was Adonijah? He's the fourth of David's sons. Born in Hebron. Remember, the first 7 years of David's reign, he's in Hebron because he doesn't have all of Israel united underneath him yet. 7 years later, he will go up to Jerusalem. His first son is Amnon. Remember, Amnon was killed by Absalom. Absalom is killed by Joab, who we'll talk about in a second. He's mentioned here. And the second, Kileab, he's mentioned in 2 Samuel 3, and then he's never mentioned again. So we assume maybe he died as a child or died somewhere along the way. So number four is Adonijah, and he's the oldest surviving son at this point. Okay. So in verse 5, Adonijah, it says Adonijah exalted himself. It implies that he's clearly usurping David's, and furthermore, God's right to designate a successor. Because up to this point, I know I've got another slide, but let me hit it now. Up to this point, how were kings chosen? It's only happened twice, but how were kings chosen in Israel? Yes. God chose them and said... chose a prophet and said, you go tell him he's king. It was the word of the Lord that decided kings. It wasn't just, hey, I'll just be a king. We haven't had what you see, you know, sons upon sons upon sons. David is not Saul's son, so it's not necessarily down that road. So God is supposed to be the one that chooses the king for his people. And Adonijah is jumping the gun. He's doing it himself. He exalts himself. God exalted David. Adonijah exalts himself. And so he's trying to take power. Again, this contrasts with David, who waited patiently for God to raise him to office, even refusing to take Saul's life. I mean, remember, we got all the stories of David had every opportunity to take Saul out if he really wanted to, and I will not lay my hand on God's anointed. God will put me there in time. He's, you know, David was anointed, and he knows God has chosen him for something, and there are times, you just read the Psalms, where David doesn't know what the heck's going on, and he's confused, and he's depressed, and he's despondent, but he doesn't take it into his own hands. Remember all his men in the cave that time when Saul is covering his feet in the old language. He was his morning constitutional that he's taking there. Fairly vulnerable position, I would imagine. I just picture the, again, it's great to be there because we stayed at En Gedi one night, which is where David hid from Saul in those caves. And they have all these ridges and stuff and caves you can see. All these little mountain goats jumping around, the ibex, the national animal of Israel or whatever. And you could just picture, like, Saul has come down the thing, and he's walking on down there in the valley, and David pops out of one of the caves and calls to him. You know, and you see him looking up there, and David waving the piece of his robe. You know, this is what, you were just here. This is what I could have done, and I didn't touch you, you know. And remember, Saul basically praises him up and down at that point, says, you're such a better guy than I am. I'm such a horrible person. And then the next week, he's trying to kill him again. But he has a moment of, oh, man, yeah, Saul realizes it. He's just off the rails sometimes. All right, so again, David the patient one, waiting, even though he's dealing with a terrible king, and then Adonijah is dealing with David, who's, you know, the king, the man after God's own heart, not without faults, not without problems, but he's trying to get ahead of God a little. And I think what verse 6 tells us is that David is partially responsible for this. It says, and it's kind of a weird translation the way we read it, but it says that his father had not displeased him at any time in saying, why hast thou done so? Essentially what that's saying is that David was never around. You know, David was not there to discipline his son, to tell his son, son, you're doing wrong. You know, you shouldn't be doing that. You're making mistakes. Adonijah was the oldest son of the king. He did whatever he wanted to do, and nobody told him anything. He's a spoiled brat. That's what he is. And so I think what you see is that David was a bit neglectful at times as a parent. I think you see that with Absalom. I think you see it on down the line. He's a pretty good father to Solomon. I don't know that he's a great father to some of these other guys. And I think that's what you get with Adonijah. Nobody's ever told Adonijah to stop, to sit down, to spank him. Nobody's ever done that to him. He's always done what he's wanted to do, and his father has never told him anything was wrong. And so how do you get to the rebellious son? I think that's one route to get there.
Well, and if nobody's done that, it would be natural for him to think, hey, I'm number one.
Yeah, I'm entitled. Yeah, exactly. And look, it says he was also a goodly man, and his mother bare him after Absalom. I mean, he's not necessarily this evil, despotic guy. He's a good guy. He's just spoiled. He's just entitled. He wants what's his. And notice that they mention Absalom there. I think that's purposeful on the author's part to associate the rebellion of Absalom and Adonijah, two sons that tried to overstep their bounds and get in front of God a little bit.
Did David not teach them that God had positioned him and that,
yeah,
you know, that they needed to wait for God's calling?
Yeah, obviously not clearly enough.
Yeah.
Or they're just totally ignoring it.
Right.
And we've got 2 Samuel 7 that says your seed is going to be on the throne. So, yeah, I think that's it. Yeah.
As a historian, looking back through what you've learned over all the years, isn't this something that we see over and over again amongst great leaders?
Sure.
That their own home suffers, mm-hmm, in contrast to where the leader spends all his time and energy.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's plenty of good exceptions to it, but as a rule,
yeah,
we see that way too often.
Yeah, I think it's the cautionary tale for those of us that have a lot on our plates. You know, we can be very busy, and it's not important work, and we stuff for people, and we can be loving people, and we can be doing great things, and yet we can be ignoring what's right there. I think that's one of the applications that we can practically get from this is, you know, he's not a bad kid, but he's going in the wrong direction. You know, he's nice, he's polite, he's respectful. You know, plays church really well, but he's going the wrong direction because David hasn't guided him. So Adonijah is obviously arrogant. He exalts himself. He gets himself chariots. He's got 50 men running in front of him. He wants to make this a procession. People wants to announce his presence with authority. He's never been corrected or disciplined. He's a handsome guy, and he's the oldest living son of the king. I mean, he's living high on the hog. It's great. You know, he's going to move right into this role. Thinks it's a perfectly natural progression. So Adonijah recruits two guys, Joab and Abiathar. Okay, now, if you read David's exploits, you will see Joab and Abiathar over and over and over again. Joab is David's general. He's the military guy. Now, Joab does what David tells him to do, and Joab does things for himself as well. Joab is the one, the verse we've got here, in 2 Samuel 5, David said on that day, whosoever gets up to the gutter or the water shaft and smites the Jebusites, he shall be chief and captain. Remember, they figure out, we can't get into Jerusalem. It was Jebus at that time. The Jebusites occupied it. And he says, we can't get in there. We're going to have to go up through the water shaft. And Joab says, whoever does it gets to be my chief captain. And Joab leads the troops up through the water shaft and takes Jerusalem. Yes?
Did you say that Joab killed one of the sons?
Yes.
Of David? So this guy is joining up with the guy that killed his brother?
Yes. Joab kills Absalom after David says, don't kill him. Absalom rebels, and remember, David says, I'll forgive him. Just capture him. Don't. Once they put the rebellion down, don't execute it. And Joab executes him anyway. So Joab is politically expedient. He is loyal to David until now, but he's also done some things on his own, sort of rogue, sort of. He's dangerous, and he's a military, you know, general. I mean, he's a dangerous guy. He's got a lot of support. He's got a lot of resources, and he's kind of cutthroat when it comes down to getting things done. So that's Joab. And then Abiathar is the priest, 1 Samuel 22. This is where he comes. And one of the sons of Ahimelech and the son of Ahitub named Abiathar escaped and fled after David. He was with Saul. He jumps ship and comes to David's side. And Abiathar showed David that Saul had slain the Lord's priests. Once Saul goes too far, Abiathar runs to David and says, I'm going to serve you. You're the king. I don't want to serve him anymore. So Abiathar has been the religious leader for David all these years. So his best military man and his best priest are now going over with his son. Okay. For whatever reason, obviously political reasons are playing a big part here. Okay, they've been with David since the beginning. Joab conquered Jerusalem. He led Israel to many military victories, and he helped David through the Absalom debacle, even after killing Absalom. And Abiathar is a priest who has always been loyal to David. So those are two big names that go with Adonijah. And then we've got Adonijah's coronation. Lacking a clear consensus, Adonijah pushes forward with his plans to become king. If it was a consensus decision, everybody would have been there. Adonijah doesn't invite some people because he knows some people aren't going to be on his side. He knows he's doing wrong. And so he only invites the people that he thinks he can influence. He offers sacrifices, invites strategically important persons to a meal, all of which is intended to unite the group. So think about the people that he does invite. He invites all his brothers, okay, to kind of make sure that they're on his side, except for Solomon. So the fact that he doesn't invite Solomon, that should give us a hint that somebody, either David or Nathan or somebody, had probably mentioned Solomon as a possible successor. Because if it was just, if nobody had ever been named, well, you just invite all your brothers. But he invites all his brothers except for Solomon. So Solomon is the threat in Adonijah's mind. So it must have been mentioned somewhere before. And then
perhaps it was obvious that Solomon was the favorite.
Yes,
son
exactly. Yeah, David had given enough hints where it was leaning that direction. And then all the men of Judah, the king's servants, if I can get the king's household on my side and I can get all my brothers on my side, it really won't matter who stands against us. Okay, we'll be
able to.
He's
talking about just the servants or the whole tribe of Judah.
I think a lot of people within Judah's tribe. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. As many people as he can find to support his cause. Okay, now this isn't the original picture I had, and I don't like it nearly as much, but I wanted to give you a picture of Jerusalem. Now, this is not Jerusalem in David's day. This is Jerusalem in Jesus' day. Okay, so you can obviously see the Temple Mount up there. This is the city of David. Okay, that's it. That was Jerusalem when David was in power. That's all the further, which I get out of your way. That's the all the further it was. Okay, the city of David is like 8 square miles. You can walk it. You can walk from here to here in about a minute and a half. It's tiny. And so this is all it was. Okay, this comes in when Solomon takes over because he's going to build the temple. This is like 24 square miles. So this probably isn't even a good scale model because this is probably too big on the scale. So this is like 24. This is like 8 or 9. Okay, all this doesn't come in until Hezekiah comes around. So even through 1 Kings, this is all Jerusalem is right here. Okay, so kind of keep that in mind. What you want to know with the setup of Jerusalem is it's 2 hills and 3 valleys. That's how Jerusalem sets up. So you've got the Kidron Valley over here. Okay, Mount of Olives is up here. Okay, Kidron Valley here. Hinnom Valley runs this way. And then a central valley that runs right through here. You can't see it much on this map because the Temple Mount swallows most of it up. And today it's not even there because when they tore the temple down, all the fill went into the central valley. So it's not really there. So you've got Mount Moriah, where the Temple Mount is, and you've got the Western Hill over here. So valley, 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 hill, and hill. Okay, that's Jerusalem. And that's the old city of Jerusalem right there. And where do they go for the coronation? Is right down here, right off the map, where these two valleys come together. Okay, the Gihon Spring is over here. That's where they get all their water supplies from to fulfill the city. That's why they built Hezekiah's tunnel. Remember I told you guys about that, 1,750 feet, and it runs all the way down here to the Pool of Siloam so that this side of the city can get water. But back in the city of David, you only need this because this is all the city there was. Okay. Does that make sense? Any questions on that? Okay. You know I got to throw some maps in there real quick. All right, so who's not invited? Okay, these are important names too, and we're about out of time. Zadok, who's David's other priest. Zadok is where the Sadducees get their name. That's where they like to ascribe themselves to him. Benaiah is the head of David's elite guard. So he's the Praetorian Guard if he was a Roman emperor or something. The Cherethites and the Pelethites are an interesting group. They seem to be a mercenary group that is loyal to David. Special forces, mercenary soldiers that come in and do missions for David. Nathan, who's the court prophet, and Nathan is the honest, straightforward, step all over your toes court prophet. See why Adonijah doesn't want him coming to the party. David's mighty men, those guys that are loyal to David, and then Solomon. So it's clear at this point that Adonijah does not have unanimous support because these guys aren't coming. And look what we've got. We've got the guy that bears the sword. We've got the religious authority. We've got the voice of God. And then we've got a loyal, all these, some armed guys, some guys that can take care of business that are there with David, and then just Solomon. So clearly, Adonijah knows I don't have the full support, and I kind of got to push this through real quick, but maybe try to get it under their nose and get myself crowned king before they all find out about it. And what's going to happen, we won't get to it today, is Nathan's going to get wind of it, and Nathan's going to start working on his end. And he's going to enlist Solomon and Bathsheba and everything else that we've got going on. So you'll see some very familiar names as we get through chapter 1. All right. Any questions on that?
Yeah. I totally forgot to pass it out. It was under my Bible. So if anyone has something pressing, please write over here before you leave. Sorry.
Or email this week or whatever. Let me know. I'll get it out. All right. Let me close this in prayer, and then we'll get out of here. Father, thank you for today. Thank you for your word, and I pray that this would be a prosperous study for us, that you would continue to teach us through your word, that we could learn lessons from your leaders and your people, both good and bad, that we can apply to our lives, and help us to not just read it as a story, not just Sunday school it. Let's really get into it and study what your word has to say for us. Bless the services today. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.